Hi, it's Dr. Gar with another podcast from The Shrink Is In. And today, my guest is Dr. Kim Bullock, who's a professor at Stanford University and one of my favorite psychiatrists, especially in the world of VR. It's Dr. Gar for The Shrink Is In. And today my guest is Dr. Kim Bullock, who has a very impressive and extensive professional background. So I can't address everything because we'll run out of time. So I'm going to just hit the key points that I think are important. And I'll put her information underneath this podcast so you could get a better picture. So let me tell the audience that Dr. Bullock is a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences within Stanford's School of Medicine. Dr. Bullock is certified in psychiatry, neuropsychiatry, lifestyle medicine, and DBT certified by the Linehan Institute. And she's the founder and director of Stanford's Neurobehavioral Clinic and Virtual Reality Immersive Technologies Program and Laboratory. Dr. Bullock has a lot of publications out there with a lot of very well-known people. I have the list here and I could see, Skip Rizzo and Jeremy Balanson and who else? Riva and there's a guy named Gurr down here too. So, So I'm going to leave that list as well. I think it's important to know that from my perspective, and it may not be as significant to you, but I met Dr. Bullock in the SPITC meetings that she's created, which I think it's a great format and platform for people to talk about extended reality and mixed reality. And I've attended as many meetings as I possibly could. And I think that it's amazing to me that the population of attendees ranges from high school kids, who I think were incredibly impressive, to established researchers in extended reality and virtual reality, and then people who are developing platforms and products. So I think it's a great way to kind of share what's known and what's the trajectory, so to speak, in virtual reality. So I thank you for that. And without dragging this out even further, welcome to The Shrink Is In, Dr. Bullock.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And Howard, you've been such a helpful part of my own trajectory and skill in using and integrating VR into practice. And because you're one of the few that's just using it clinically and using the tools that I'm using and have been doing it a little bit longer than me. And you were always so supportive and then validating. And if I'm having trouble and you're having trouble, then I know I'm not crazy or, or I'm not missing something. And so, because there's not a lot of us out there that are really using it day to day. So really appreciate having your support and interaction and communication.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And you're right. There aren't too many of us out there, which is... Yeah. Still startling to me, but I guess I understand all of the roadblocks and pitfalls about why it really hasn't been as adopted, I think, as it should be. So I know how I got here. So maybe you can tell the audience how you decided to use VR in your therapy tool bag, so to speak.
Yeah, it was a very long and winding road. A lot of wayfaring. It wasn't intentional. But if I go back to my undergraduate years, I was studying economics and I was also doing psychology. And I took a perceptual psychology class with Professor Ramachandran and I really loved it and started getting, and he was a neurologist and a PhD. And so he was bringing up these cases of using mirror therapy and visual illusions in medicine. And that really got me interested in medicine. And I really think, some of it started there. And then I thought I was going to be a neurologist. And then I went and, you know, got more interested in more complex versions of medicine and the brain, and figured out that psychiatry was going to be more challenging and more of an adventure, and there was more that was not known. And so I did end up going into psychiatry, but with the kind of a heavy bend on neuropsychiatry. And then my professional career kind of got routed towards helping this very challenging population that there was not a lot of treatments for, called functional neurological disorder, which is actually the root of psychiatry and neurology. It was also called conversion disorder or hysteria, and psychotherapy actually with, you know, Carl Jung and Freud started with these cases of women with PTSD basically having motor and sensory symptoms that were unexplained by the neurological exam. And so, and they found that having talk therapy helped these clients recover. So I started treating this population and found that there was physical therapy was also helping them. So I felt like we needed talk therapy, but we also needed more availability and evidence-based treatments that involved the body and somatic symptoms. And I wanted to use technology. And I was finding I had all these ideas and felt like nobody was really listening to me. And like most academic settings, there was a lot of gender inequity. And I just felt like, God, I just can't get my ideas out there. Nobody's letting me play in the sandbox. Mm-hmm. So I went to some leadership classes and learned about, basically, I think it's that you need to work collectively together in order to get things done, especially when there's implicit biases diversity issues going on, that you need to do things collectively and that you have to have networks of conversations mm-hmm. and move things together. So I started this consortium for functional neurological disorder, and we started to make a lot of progress to get studies done. And I was, when I was trying to look into some kind of technology, I was thinking about using virtual reality because Jeremy Bailenson is on our campus at Stanford. And I went through his lab, and he had a graduate student that was working with pain and physical therapy. And we thought, oh yeah, I think that we could actually develop something that might be really useful that to deal with motor and sensory symptoms. So, and it was just, the timing was perfect because it was around 2014-15 and the Vive was coming out and all the gaming made it available in the office. So I could, a lot of the software and the programs they were using, we didn't have to go through Jeremy Bailenson's, you know, $1 million lab. I could bring it into my office. Right. So we developed mirror therapy and Q desensitization for these folks and started to try it out and had some remarkable results. And so did a clinical trial using that. And then when I was doing that, I realized, wow, you could really do this and incorporate virtual reality into just plain old CBT work, which I was doing anyway. Mm-hmm. And luckily we had my chair, the department was really interested in technology and doing new and innovative things and supported me in creating, along with the grant that I got for doing the clinical trial, to start the first academic virtual reality clinic where we would use virtual reality to augment psychotherapy in the clinics. So we were able to start that clinic with the support of everyone. So then that became, I got so much excitement about that, and my focus kind of got taken away from the functional neurological disorder work. And there were some other junior colleagues that wanted to kind of take that work on, that I decided to kind of pivot to virtual reality for all sorts of diagnoses and used the same sort of technology of leveraging groups of people to make change rather than just relying on myself to do change, and started the consortium. And we were able to really make a lot of connections and networks and support. And I think we've been able to do all sorts of things because of just having a collective conversations and networking together. So that's kind of how it all started. Sorry, that's a bit long-winded.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I think it's important to hear all of that. I think people who are not exposed to, institutional biases and restrictions and, almost going down to like return on investments, and understanding how I think adopting a new technology in practice is like sloughing through the trenches, because there's so much resistance to anything that's new or anything that seems to be, a little off the beaten path. And I think that's always been an issue in private practice and also in institutions, because of all sorts of concerns, I guess, about litigation, evidence-based research that needs to be done, and of course, the bottom line is, do we make money off of this?
Yeah, anything new, people, there's going to be a natural resistance,
right? And when you look at, like, for example, in the early 70s, I was doing research on biofeedback, alpha wave training. And no one heard of it and no one understood what it was. And it was like parapsychology at the time. But then somewhere down the road, it became more legitimate and accepted. But it took years and years and years. I think that's the case here. That's been my experience with VR as well. We kind of talked briefly about adoption issues in the very beginning. And so I'm kind of curious. I know what I see on my end as a clinical practitioner. And I'm just curious what you see almost from an institutional-based environment.
Yeah. So the evidence is actually there now. Now we have 3 decades of how VR can augment and is not inferior to therapy without it. There has not been a lot of, I think there needs to be more research on how it enhances therapy rather than looking at efficacy, because a lot of the studies on VR are like, is it superior to the treatment without VR, and rather than looking at how it augments already existing treatments. But I think that one of the things the other thing is that all evidence-based therapies, it's hard to get people to do them, even people that are trained in them. I think a lot of the research is showing that even clinicians that are trained in evidence-based therapies don't always deliver them. Most of the time don't, or sometimes they think they're delivering them and they're not. Yeah. So just getting people to do behaviors in a way that's effective is hard collectively. And I also think that people are kind of risk averse. And so there needs to be a critical mass of people or certifications or standards or something that has not been developed yet. Standardized trainings that then deliver certifications. But even that sometimes is also difficult to get people on board. But if they become requirements and then I think there's a training gap. So even though I'm willing to, train, I have trainees in both psychology and medicine and psychiatry. Hardly anybody signs up for my rotations. So there's a training gap. So I do think some of it could start maybe earlier on with, we've got the ACGME for psychiatry that needs to have standards of what's going to be included in the curriculum. So I think a lot of problems that come out that end up in the wild are due to training gaps. So until we get that in the pipeline for training, we're probably going to have some a lot of problems with acceptability. The other thing I was thinking, psychiatrists in general. So I'm a psychiatrist, not a psychologist. Don't do a lot of evidence-based treatments. So, and I was trying to figure out why, in prepping for this, just thinking about like, what are the barriers? And I think traditionally we've been kind of distinguished ourselves by psychodynamic therapy. And so a lot of the training for psychiatrists is not towards short-term CBT. We kind of let that, we kind of farm that out to the psychologists. So you've already got a barrier there. But the technology piece of it might be able to draw some more of the psychiatrist in. But I don't see that. It doesn't seem to be happening. So seems like a big pipeline problem, or the bottleneck is in provider acceptability of this
What I find here on the East Coast is that the majority of psychiatrists really are psychopharmacologists.
Yeah.
And again, it goes down to, you know, where do they make their money? Well, if I'm going to see 10 patients in an hour or an hour and a half and bill out for services just because I'm doing, you know, medication management, then, sorry about that. Then why would I, you know, invest my time in some kind of treatment modality that's more, I guess, timed, you know, like a time code, you know, so I wouldn't make as much money doing that if I went to the treatment side. So I could see where psychiatrists would leave that to the psychologist and say, listen, you take care of that. I'll just do the medication management. And, you know, watch it from that end. And what I find here is I, when I treat patients who are seen by psychiatrists, I become the eyes and ears of the psychiatrist. And so they rely on me to give them feedback about how things are going, because they're going to see that patient maybe once every 2 months or whatever. And I'm seeing them on a weekly basis. So it becomes, you know, this kind of package.
Yeah.
The psychiatrist does their thing and I do my thing. And so I guess from my perspective, the only way I think it's going to make an investment and into the therapeutic modality is if it comes from, if VR comes from institutions or large groups where somebody will say, you know, I have, you know, 20 psychologists or 20 therapists or whatever, and two or three of them are going to be trained in VR. And so those are going to be the VR people. And
it's a specialty.
And I think, unfortunately, it is a specialty. But, you know, referring
it's
back
not,
to.
Yeah, but it's not a recognized, you know, there's no organization that's recognizing it as a specialty, though. Like,
You know, people are trying, but I think that, you know, like AMXRA is trying. I think they're also looking at the possibility of coming up with a credentialing program.
But training, again, I think it comes back to this training gap. Yeah. The training institutions need to create a specialty.
And I also, and, you know, getting back to your earlier statement about efficacy, you know, I see VR as a tool.
Yeah.
And I think it enhances, my work is really in exposure therapy for anxieties and phobias. And so I'm localized in that realm. Obviously, VR can be used for a variety of things beyond that, but I'm not going to step into the territory that I am not comfortable with.
Yeah.
And so I know that realm. And what I see is a VR enhances and speeds up the entire process.
Yeah. And that may be why unconsciously, or I guess in CBT terminology, without awareness, providers could be shaped into, like, it's a lot of work to do something really efficiently and quickly. And you make a lot more money if you do it slowly and maybe not as efficiently. I'm sorry to say,
I get that. I get that.
You know, it's a lot of, you know, to do things efficiently in a private practice, you may not have the same motivation and you might want to go a little slower. So, you know, I mean, drawing new patients. I mean, I think you're an exception, Howard, because, and you probably have to work a lot harder to get patients if you got the flow going in and out more quickly, as opposed to having a psychodynamic or psychoanalytic patient for 2 years. You know, you just, you've got that security and
annuity.
And continuity, yes.
No, annuity.
Yeah. There could also be some factors, at least in private practice, of being super efficient too.
Yeah, I think that is an issue, and it does require the understanding that you know there's a turnover rate.
Yeah,
and you know I'm finished with patients between 8 and 10 sessions, doing mm-hmm. what I'm doing, and so. There is that need, I guess, to have, I guess, a solid practice.
And a business background to be able to get enough, people attracted to your business, too. So,
but that's what I think the niche is. I think it's, you know, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he thought he was the only one who had a phobia of a particular thing. I said, you know, you talk to a bunch of people and you scratch the surface a little. You're going to find a lot of people have similar phobic reactions. They just don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and he said, wow, you know, the more I talk to people, the more I hear. So all of a sudden he felt better. You know, so I think that that's a common reaction, that people just don't understand the expanse of psychological and emotional issues and how everybody's walking around with something, but you know, we're able to avoid certain circumstances that, you know, are easily avoidable at the time. That doesn't mean they're always going to be easily avoidable. And so there are people out there who have issues that they've, you know, avoided for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden some life change occurs. No, I can't do it anymore. Now I really have to face that. Like, I haven't flown in 20 years. Now all of a sudden I have to fly. And you know, all my anxieties come flying out, so to speak. But I think that, you know, besides the fact that there's not enough training, I also think, at least from the psychologist side, ultra conservative population, and people who don't want to take risks, putting themselves in a vulnerable position, and also have no clue that they're in a business.
Yes. No training in that too.
No, none. And so the idea of, you know, making investments and getting return on investments or finding a niche, you know, it just, it doesn't occur to them.
Yeah.
And so there's that piece. And then there's the other piece. And this is, I guess I wanted to talk to you about this one as well. I've heard this from other clinicians that they believe anything that's technological gets in the way of the therapeutic relationship.
Oh, right. That kind of implicit bias against technology.
Because it's another thing in the room or it's another thing that's in between them. And now we have somebody who's sitting there with a headset on.
Yeah.
And so they are excluded from the actual environment that they're sitting in and the clinicians seated in. And so does that make them more removed from the clinical therapeutic relationship? My experience is no, I don't see that.
There's some evidence that actually people can read emotions better if they're just getting the audio, like the visual gets in the way of encoding the emotional tone and everything. So sometimes audio, you know, people can communicate better just by audio, I would argue, but. And then they don't really realize that when you do VR psychotherapy, there's only a very small proportion of the time that you're even in VR, you know? It becomes a kind of mute point.
No, I understand, but I always, that's the piece that comes up when I talk to other
clients. Yeah. But, you know, I think for patients, the other side of the coin is it's so validating and destigmatizing to know that, oh, God, I thought I was alone in this weird phobia. Oh, my God, no, I'm not. There's actually a whole technology that was made for me, you know, that technology and industry put the time into actually creating something for my phobia. So it isn't weird. You know, I feel like that's like from the patient's point of view, the technology is like, oh, yeah, I want it. It's because it's technology.
Yeah, I think there's an entertaining component to it, you know, and it's also
destigmatizing, I think.
Yeah. And it's also kind of easier in view of the fact that, you know, you don't have to rely on imaginative skills.
Yes.
And patients can't hold on to images, especially phobic related images that they're avoiding. And so the VR just makes it so much easier because they're now fed the information that they need and they don't have to put the energy in that. Now they just have to deal with reacting and understanding how they're reacting.
Yeah, I think it's like a prosthetic for imagination. And because of neurodiversity issues, because of insults to the nervous system, people's ability to imagine can be compromised, and because of high emotion. And so it's a lot to ask a patient to imagine their most feared stimuli. And some people cannot do it. And so this allows that bridge so they can desensitize. So I think that's an important thing to remember too.
Yeah. And I think the technology is getting so much better. You know, if you go back 10 years or so, it was cumbersome headsets, and not such great resolution, you know, poor refresh rates, the technology you needed, the processing power you needed was incredible, and it was very expensive.
Yeah. But the problem now is they're not pivoting to telehealth. So our whole medical system, at least in mental health, most of us have pivoted to doing most treatment remotely. And I feel like that technology has not advanced how to deliver these treatments remotely. And you and I know there's about only one company who's been able to make that leap.
Well, they made that leap in an economical way. There are other companies out there with packages, but I think, you know, we discussed that the onboarding sometimes is difficult.
Yeah, they haven't mastered it.
No. Yeah. So I think that they're on the path.
Yes.
But we're not where we need to be.
And then the other issue is the Google, YouTube used to be a huge source of stimuli, idiosyncratic stimuli. And now the Google Cardboard option has been taken off, which was a big blow to my practice. So now I can't deliver for free, you know, things that were able to be delivered. And we had a huge library of content there that is now lost. So I'm waiting for that.
You pointed that out to me, and I was behind that one. And when I did look at it, I realized, oh my God, it is all gone.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, when they stopped supporting the daydream because it wasn't really making, I guess, any headway in the marketplace, they just pulled the plug. And there's a certain amount of like,
and they weren't thinking about mental health. This, they had no idea we were using it in that way, I'm sure, when that decision was made.
I actually think they don't care.
Yeah. It's not on their radar.
You know, like Google used to have, Google had Hangouts, Google Hangouts, which was a platform where people could just like talk to one another. Mm-hmm. And then they came out with Google Helpouts. Mm-hmm. And Google Helpouts was a platform where professionals, any professional or any expert, could offer their services to anyone. And you could either charge or not charge. It didn't really matter. And they invested some time and energy into it. It had some potential. And then they just pulled the plug on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and there was no warning. It was just, it was gone.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of their strategy with things. We're going to invest some time in it. We're going to put some money in it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, we'll just move on.
Well, this brings up another barrier, I think, is so industry is doing amazing things. And they're working on these business models that have to do with organizations and, you know, making it financially sustainable, which I understand. But they're not thinking about the design with actually providers in mind. So a lot of them do focus on the patients, but the providers like us that are going to be using these things are often left out kind of in the whole design thinking, I feel.
Yeah, I I've talked to many companies over the years in terms of what clinicians need and how to manage their platform. And the bottom line has always been, from my perspective, you have to make it as simple as possible. It has to be technologically
idiot proof.
Yeah, you know, I hate to say that, but yeah, and
yeah, like an iPhone, yeah, or something. Yeah, yeah. Apple
right,
does
exactly.
A good way. Yeah, they know we're all idiots, and they design for us.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
we're not
right, and I think that that's not happening.
Yeah,
the way it should. So. People are coming up with systems that are still too complex for a clinician to pick up. And I think the other piece is that it still requires, to this day, thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
So even when you talk about, like, you know, Google videos and YouTubes, that requires you to go looking for them.
Yeah.
And then kind of saying, well, this is going to work for this patient. And I'm going to, you know, download this, and then I'm going to put this on the patient's, you know, head-mounted display, and we'll work with that.
Yeah, because right now you've got like a selection bias to providers willing to do this, early adopter kind of people, adventuresome. You got to be able to deal with a lot of things going wrong and not get, feeling down about it. So there is a kind of certain mindset that adopters are having. That are using it now.
I call them Frankenstein systems.
Right. And then who are we who that are willing to work with those systems?
Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah. We're weirdos.
Yeah. Well, we are. I mean, we are kind of outliers.
Well, I think, adventure. You have to kind of have an adventuresome spirit, I think, and be willing to be on the edge. And yeah.
And I think you have to kind of step into technology, open-minded and, willing to accept
flexible.
The fact that, you know, things don't always work out the way you want, but it's something that you can play with. And I guess I've always called myself a bit of a geek, but I've invested hours and hours and weeks and months on things.
Yeah. I think you're cool. I think you should say early adopter.
Okay, I'll accept early adopter. But, even as a kid, this is what I did. I took things apart, not necessarily put them back together. I designed things, I built things, I came up with ideas. Mm-hmm. That was me. And, the interesting thing is that I come from a family of electricians, and my family decided that I was going to be an electrical engineer.
Oh, yeah.
That was their decision. And I was an engineering major for about 2 weeks. And I decided, no, I don't want to do this. So I went to psychology, and that's where I kind of stuck. But interesting enough, my son's an electrical engineer. And it kind of like continued.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Isn't that funny how that legacy goes? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of a neglected latchkey a kid from a single mom, the only child. So no one was ever telling me what to do. So I just did things. So I think I was like, I never waited around for someone to tell me to do something. So I just do it. And then people are like so amazed. And I'm like, I don't know. This is just how I operate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that separates us from.
Yeah.
The people who kind of walk the traditional path and do everything as their kind of told to, in a sense, and don't step out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, yeah. And hopefully that won't, yeah, it could be start to be part of the status quo, and it won't be so, it won't be just for outliers. It will be more mainstream. And I think that is coming. I mean, you know, you think about radios and all the technology, there were the early adopters, and then it became more mainstream.
Well, you can, you know, go back to the iPhone statement.
Yeah.
You know, who, you know, if you go back 20 years or so, you know, who had an iPhone?
Yeah.
Who had a cell phone?
Yeah.
And now you can't leave the house without it.
Yeah.
It's become so integrated in life.
Yeah.
And that's where I think extended reality has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be so involved in our lives that we use it all the time. And I think at that point, people are going to go, oh, you know, you could use this for mental health issues too. Like,
yeah,
there'll be a revelation like it never occurred before.
Yeah. Jared Lanier has talked a lot about this in the future. I think he's right on. It's going to be our new way of communicating. And it's going to be more storytelling. It's going to change humanity the way that we use this type of technology.
No, I agree. I just hope it happens sooner than later.
Yeah.
But I think that the pandemic really has sped this whole process up.
Yes. It has not sped up the telehealth version of this, but it has sped up VR. And yeah, I'm hoping they'll get to the telehealth, getting that technology up to speed. But you're right, it's really been the kind of changer, enzyme for change.
So I had a question about one of your research articles on eating disorders in VR.
Oh yeah,
because that's always been a nagging issue in the back of my head. I'm not trained in eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is, but I'm not.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I always wondered, you know, I've seen VR environments in terms of, you know, body dysmorphia kind of things, and even like, you know, eating in a public place. But I'm just kind of curious how and what you did with eating disorders.
Yeah, and I don't want to claim all the credit for it. I was kind of a consultant. We have an eating disorders clinic. Mm-hmm. So I collaborated on this, and I am not an eating disorder specialist, mm-hmm. but I did convince them to do this study because I was intrigued by the research on this. And, you know, the way I think about it, you know, there's three different aspects to eating disorders. So there's, you know, the impulse control, either avoidance or lack of avoidance of food. So there's the eating itself. Then there's the body image dissatisfaction. And then there's body image distortion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like three parts of the treatment that you need to help a person go into remission for that are involved with eating disorders. And so VR is, there's evidence that VR can help in all three of those realms. And that's, you know, I'm more interested in kind of embodied illusions and how that can change our implicit biases and things like that. I think we forget it's not just a desensitization tool, but it can actually change your belief systems for, mm-hmm. you know, because beliefs are shifted by when you have a prediction, and then that prediction you predict something, then you do the experiment and it comes out differently than you expected, an expectancy violation and incongruence, and then you update your learning. And so you can do that with these illusions, and there's the allocentric lock theory. I don't know if you've heard about this from Giuseppe Riva first mm-hmm. talked about this. And this was another reason because when I was doing the VR work, one of my mentors was an eating disorder specialist, and he showed me all these new studies that were coming out that he was really excited about. And Giuseppe Riva's idea about this allocentric lock theory, that your body image is decided by your experiences and implicit biases and how you think you look from the outside world, and then how you feel from the inside coming up from your interoceptive sensations to your perceptions, and then from your what your culture, what your experiences about how other people see you are. And that when you enter into a VR avatar and have an embodied body transfer experience, that you can update these experiences. You can update that allocentric point of view, what you look like, what you think you look like, and also your interoceptive sensations. And people tend to improve their body satisfaction after having these experiences. So like really obese people get into a into an avatar in a normal weight kind of avatar experience, you would think that that would make them feel more, when they're outside of that experience, they would feel more dissatisfied. But no, it's the opposite. They actually feel more satisfied with their body. Mm-hmm. So it's model updating their perceptions of themselves. And that translates to healthier eating patterns. And then that cue desensitization can work for also for eating patterns and help with emotion regulation. You can point out to people their images, their body image distortions, and how different it is from reality in these VR experiences. So there's just like so much room for work with VR. It's super exciting to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's how I understand. But again, I'm not an eating disorder specialist. But the paper that we did, that we worked on the cue part of it, the cue desensitization, and the group Deborah Safer and Kristen Renfola are really, you know, taking this idea and running with it and adapted Giuseppe Riva's protocol that was more for the Italian culture, and they adapted it for the U.S. culture in a culturally sensitive way, and are now really becoming specialized in that area.
Well, okay. Yeah, I think that's a whole new approach that has a lot of merit.
Yeah.
But
another colleague of mine, again, this was just from a network of conversations, Carolyn Rodriguez got the idea to use VR in hoarding. And she just finished a pilot study that's showing a lot of promise. It was a single arm study that showed that practicing discarding they go in and they take a picture of people's environments at home, because a lot of problems with hoarding is just that they're avoiding discarding. It's like an avoidance of discarding. And, and so they get to practice the discarding without having to actually let it go. So it's kind of in virtuo discarding behaviors in their own environments. And it helps them to augment this evidence-based treatment called Buried in Treasures. That's like remarkable. What a great use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. A lot of promise here.
And
people have to really start working on these ideas and expanding on them, because.
Yeah, getting them to market too. That's a challenge.
Yeah. I think part of the problem with the market is that not a lot of the people who are producing aren't necessarily mental health professionals.
Yeah.
And so somehow they're missing some of it. And I think that there's going to be a collapsing of the market, because
they don't have enough input. How can you design something without the users involved?
Right. And I think that a lot of these companies can't sustain themselves.
Yeah.
There are good product designs, but the marketplace is limited.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can invest a lot of time and money, but not really be able to sell your product.
Yeah.
So I think that eventually, the 114 companies that I've collected in the behavioral health realm are going to collapse, and we're going to probably have two or three major players.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have to merge and kind of cooperate with one another to create the products that I think are going to be most marketable.
Yeah. And they're going to really need to collaborate more with the providers. I can't even get a conflict of interest. Nobody will take me as an advisor.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. They just don't care what I have to say. Yeah. It's really interesting. No, there's a huge barrier. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
I know. And they don't want to talk to a psychiatrist. Not one of these boards has a psychiatrist involved. You would think like, okay, well, don't you need to kind of expand your to the medical people too? So it's really bizarre. And I interact with a lot of companies, so it's not from lack of interaction or, yeah.
I think it's lack of awareness.
So I think you're right. There, and the ones that are doing that are going to survive because they'll create something of quality, hopefully, and that will be of use.
I was anxiously hoping that when Apple joined the fray, that things would become much more polished. And it may still happen, but not the first or two generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I figure maybe 3 years from now, we'll see a big transition. Anyway, we're out of time.
All right.
Yeah. So Kim, this was great.
Oh, it's so fun.
Yeah. It was good talking to you. It was good, just going back and forth on this virtual reality and talking about the trajectory and where we'd like it to go. And unfortunately, the roadblocks, but hopefully those roadblocks will disappear. And I definitely appreciate your SPITC meetings. I think they're great. And maybe we'll do this another time. So to my audience, again, this is Dr. Howard Gurr for The Shrink Is It. Until next time.